It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 2 of Terry's Talking, your new favorite podcast. Hey, this is David Campbell. I'm sports manager at Cleveland.com, joined as always by Terry Pluto, award-winning sports writer and author of the upcoming book, Vintage Browns, right? I got the title right?
You've got it. It's not hard, so that'll be good. Coming out hopefully in a couple months. So
excellent. We'll look forward to that. Hopefully we'll get to it.
Because as you know, with things that used to be on schedule don't exactly run on the schedules that they used to.
That's right. Everything's slow, supply chain issues and all that. So I didn't get the chance to ask you last week, what did you think of the theme song that I picked? Did you hear it?
No.
Okay, so check it out. It's called Icarus. I wanted to give these guys a shout out. It's called Icarus, and it's got a little catchy beat to it, but it's I thought it was interesting. It's by this group called the El Flaco Collective, and I'm like, Icarus. You remember that from like Greek mythology, the whole thing about Icarus? Yeah, like so I think everybody remembers the story about how Icarus had wings made out of feathers and wax, and he couldn't fly too close to the sun. So I think the message, I did this subliminally, I put it together, is like this, let's make this podcast as good as it can be, but like not too close to the sun. We don't want to crash and burn. So we're going to get as close to the sun as we can.
Well, therefore, we're not going to do point spreads.
There you go. That's right.
That's a good way to crash and burn.
All right. Hey, Terry, let's get talking about the Browns. Everybody's really jacked up for this season and the opener on Sunday at Kansas City. One of the things we talked about going into the season on the Orange and Brown Talk podcast that we did with fans was like on a scale of 1 being not important and 5 being really, really important. Where do you rank this game on a scale of 1 to 5 in terms of how important it is to the Browns' fortunes this season?
Well, as I give you my number, keep in mind this is not a put down on the Browns. It's not even to say the Browns will lose, but just my view of the number 1 of 17. And I was the only one. Everybody's at 3s and 4s. I gave it a 1. And the reason being, it's 1 of 17. The reason being, remember how they got whacked in Baltimore last year? Reason being this. And this is why they actually could win, too. You just don't know. A number of years ago, I know it was probably like 20 years ago. I was at the Beacon Journal then. I was in Las Vegas covering something else, and I had a friend who knew a guy named Joe Lupo from Stowe, and he ran the sports book at the old Stardust Casino in Las Vegas. I'm not a big gambler or whatever, but I was always kind of fascinated. These are the guys, especially in the old days, they set the lines. So I went over and talked to him, and Joe told me a couple things, one of them being how basically, they could move the line more because Browns fans were so fanatic that they actually could have gotten more points or whatever, but they would just bet their team anyway. So they bet a lot of emotions. But we got on different – I said, well, there's something else. He said, well, you know, the hardcore guys – he goes, it's even hard for us. The first week of the NFL season is a nightmare. He said, we have no idea what's going to happen. And remember, this is like 20 years ago. They don't play their guys that much in the preseason. Well, now they don't even play in the preseason or whatever. He said, really, the smart money, maybe they'll bet a game, but the guys that are smart, they're studying all the games, and they come back in weeks 2 and 3. So that's why when I say this, I mean, clearly, Baltimore was at 37-8 or whatever it was last year that they lost 30-point margin. Then the next time, remember, was this great game, you know, the Baltimore won. But that was more indicative of where the Browns and Ravens were with each other as opposed to that first week. And that's why I'm saying, I mean, maybe the Browns going to whack Kansas City. I mean, who knows? But well,
it's one of 17. You're right.
One of 17. It's nice, though. In fact, somebody from the Browns told me, goes, you know, one of two things is going to happen. If we get beat, unless it's a real, real tight game, but say we get beat by 10, guy says, well, now we're imposters. He goes, and if we win, we're going to the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And he's a, and the guy says, Corley, I want to see how we play well, all these other things. But what does it really mean? I'm sticking with a one.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but before I came to Cleveland, I was working in Chicago, and I used to cover the Dave Wannstedt Bears of the early 90s.
Yeah.
And every season they would start out 4-1, 5-2, and yeah, people would be excited and the Bears fans would be going crazy. But it's like you've been around this long enough, you start to figure out championships are won and division titles and playoff berths are won in November and December. Like those are the games that are really pivotal toward the end. Like how many teams do we see every year fast start and then they just fade? It's like November, December is really crunch time. And I think you're right. We'll know more about everybody by then. So it'll be really interesting.
Certain players, like, you know, granted, Baker was in a new offense yet again. Nonetheless, the Baker Mayfield, we saw the second half of the year, I think, by the way, is closer to the Baker Mayfield that's real than in the first half. But he may just have some struggles early on too. I mean, David, when you go out and you watch training camp, and a lot of fans have done this, if you're a quarterback, you're wearing red, you might as well wear this neon sign, don't touch me, don't get near me. It creates a false sense of security for that quarterback. And once you get out there, that's why I was glad they at least said Baker had a couple of series the other day when they played their final preseason game. In fact, the first series, remember, he had two passes batted down. I just think his timing and stuff wasn't good. You can't replicate it. So we'll see. And I think as the season goes on, you know, the quarterback and everybody else grows together.
Cool. So you're going to be there Sunday. And yeah. So I have been to Arrowhead Stadium in the summertime. And I stayed across there when I was on a vacation out that way, but I have not been there for a game. What's it like? It seems like it's a pretty cool place to see a game.
It's like when Cleveland's rocking. It's the same thing. The people are the same way. It's Midwestern. You know, Buffalo's like that. I'm not going to say nice things about Pittsburgh because they're not allowed, but Buffalo's like that. You know, even Detroit, although they're terrible, but the people are nice. It's this feel. Just like everything's, you know, orange and brown. When the Browns play, everything is red there. And it reminded me a little bit too, many years ago, I went to Nebraska when that was back when they were just rolling middle 90s. Akron U did a money game there. And so I actually was able to stay on the sidelines in the locker room. Leon's the coach, you know, how this poor Akron U's playing Nebraska, but just the way the fans are, the way it looked, same thing out there. I love going to Kansas City for games, and I'd love to see the Browns make them very quiet as they go out of the stadium, but it's a great atmosphere. It's a tough atmosphere. Now, the curious thing, David, when was the last time these teams played with crowd noise, real crowd noise, not 10,000 crowd noise, real crowd noise?
Yeah, it's been a while. I think the last game might have been here between them before last year, if I remember.
2019, you got to go. And so that'll be interesting. I want to see how the offensive linemen handle that, all that kind of stuff. Because preseason, there's some noise, but it's nothing.
So everybody knows all about the weapons that Kansas City has. If we can go on the field for a minute here, I'm curious to get your thoughts on, like, you know, Tyreek Hill, Kelce, Mahomes. They've got so much firepower there. And I think one of the real things people are curious to see about the Browns is, like, Joe Woods has all these new players that he can deploy now. And there's a lot of curiosity about, are they going to go three safeties, two linebackers? Or are they going to go more traditional? Are they going to mix it up? How often will they go with more defensive backs? How do you think Joe Woods is going to kind of approach this going in? What do you expect to see?
A big thing, David, watching the Browns against Kansas City, and maybe once in a while sort of Baltimore or whatever, is defensively they would look slow. Now, are they faster? They're supposed to be faster starting on that defensive line. Clowney is supposed to bring some, not only the pass rushing, but just that speed like Miles has. Are they faster? Are they faster at linebacker with JLK and with Walker? Andrew Berry, I remember when they signed Walker, said he went side to side as well as anybody. They want their linebackers really to be able to run. Are they faster with Delpit? I'm assuming he's going to play. With John Johnson, as at the safeties, you know, Harrison, you have to play those three safeties against Kansas City because that's what they want to do. They want to run and gun with Mahomes. It's almost like one of those NBA three-point shooting teams. How will the Browns keep up with that? That's what I'm looking as opposed to, basically, are you faster because you're supposed to be? And then can you schematically make that work? But I'm just wondering, because that was the thing we just noticed. The Browns weren't quick enough. And then the case for Odell was offensively, the Browns needed one more speed guy. Now, I have, by the way, I know everybody says that everything's fine with Odell, but we honestly don't know. I mean, until it's we true. See him play, we right. don't know. My guess is early in the year, he's going to be pretty good. He's rested, they've trained him, all that. You know, will he hold up over a whole season? But we just don't know.
So the it's interesting you talk about the speed sideline to sideline, because I remember right after that game last year, our colleague Ellis Williams wrote a really interesting film breakdown of how the Chiefs tried to exploit that sideline to sideline speed. And we saw it on the crucial quarterback keeper at the end when the Browns couldn't get to the sideline fast enough. So I think that's going to be one of the real interesting storylines this week, is how the Browns can cover horizontally, not just down the field, but horizontally sideline to sideline. And we'll see how that goes. So
then when you throw the asterisk on there, David, too, then – okay, you're going to have, I don't know, 8 new starters or whatever it is, a lot of new starters and a lot of new players. My guess, they better look better later in the year than they do now. So they could end up being exploited. But also, I believe Kansas City has either, I think it's 4 new offensive linemen. They are really, and so that, okay, so you got a kind of a whole new defensive line other than, Miles Garrett and who else started last year?
Yeah, Billings opted out. Right, you're right.
That's it. So how do they match up with the new offensive line for Kansas City? Of course, Mahomes is a great eraser for that with his mobility to run all over, but no quarterback likes to be pressured.
So everybody, you mentioned OBJ earlier. Everybody's really interested to see how he looks. Is there one player in particular that you're really excited to see on Sunday in the opener?
This game is set up for JOK. I mean, he's supposed to be fast, linebacker, side to side. I want to see if they roll him in there and then how he does. Secondly, Clowney. Now, I saw him a couple times out there when they actually were, I think we're whatever they were doing, where it's close to tackling but not tackling, you know. His speed, just it was eye-popping. It jumped. So those were two. On the defense, I'm very sanguine or very confident in the offense. I'm not real worried about it. By the way, I do hope they run the ball a lot. Let's keep Kansas City sitting over there and let's watch Chubb and Hunt. And I mean, even just as a fan, just watch those guys run and do some play action, tight ends, all of that stuff.
I'm really interested to see Donovan Peoples-Jones. I know people want to see OBJ and coming back from the injury, but we've heard so much about DPJ, this training camp, making, you know, high pointing the ball, bringing it down in tight spaces. And if you've got Jarvis Landry and OBJ out there, there might be some room for Peoples-Jones to make some plays. So I'll be curious to see how that works out. So
you know who the best receiver is on the team.
Oh yeah. You've said this for a long time, Jarvis Landry, right?
Because to me, you know, part of it is durability. Part of it is flexibility. You know, this guy can short passes, long, he could read Baker, all that. By the way, he threw 4 passes last year and completed them all.
That's right.
So there you go. But I just have loved Landry. I mean, the guy lost his consecutive game streak at 100 or whatever it was. When he didn't even have COVID. Remember the close contact thing.
Right.
And he played on a bad hip last year because he came quickly back from hip surgery. Well, he looked dynamic against the Giants the day I was out there. And I guess I have always liked him from the moment they got him. You know, it's just he's a Browns type player.
Yeah.
I started to not play like a Brown. That was my pittance, but
play like a Landry.
Play like a Landry. Remember he did that when he yelled at those guys in the Hard Knocks. They had the meeting of the receivers. He just ripped them. Basically, it was play like a Landry.
Yeah, and he was a new guy then, right? He wasn't even like he'd been here for 5 years. He was really trying to set the tone right from the get, and that's what he's been. He's been exactly what they thought they were getting. He really has. Yep.
Yeah, and I hope that they don't fall into the salary cap thing with him. You know, it's kind of like, this is a little like Nick Chubb. You may pay more than the analytics say, because guess what? He's tough, he's smart, and he's accountable, and he's good, and he's durable.
Yep, and he impacts. Yeah, and he impacts other people around him.
Which is what
you're saying. Yeah. So, all right, let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk some Indians. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, we're back on Terry's Talking. We're going to get into a little bit of Indians here. Terry, we talked last week about how, you know, the Indians aren't battling for a playoff spot or anything, but there's a lot of really good and interesting things happen, especially with the pitching staff for next year. And I want to kind of ask what your impressions were of where they're at.
Well, I'm anxious, first of all, to see, you know, Savali's going to be pitching the rest of this month, and then we're going to go to the new guys. But the Bieber thing is interesting to me. They want him to pitch a game or two, primarily so that he goes into the offseason feeling confident about his arm and shoulder. Because no matter what they say, when this guy went out in June and they said, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, tired shoulder, whatnot. Well, here we are in September. He hasn't pitched yet. And so they want to see how that goes. I remember a number of years ago, they were at the old stadium. That's how far back. Charlie Nagy missed a whole bunch of months towards the end of the season. And they had him pitch the last game of the year just so he could get his confidence back. And that worked fine for Charlie. And he went into the next year and he had a good year. So those two. But David, all right, well, I'm going to ask you to rank them. You got McKenzie, you've got Eli Morgan, you got Quantrill. I don't think there's really much of anybody else enters into that discussion with the three young stars. How would you rank them? McKenzie, Quantrill, Morgan.
I would probably do Quantrill, McKenzie, and Morgan just from consistency, but that's me. What do you think?
Yeah, because that was kind of tug of war between McKenzie and Quantrill. McKenzie clearly could be more brilliant. Quantrill might be more, when I mentioned durable with football, again, more durable there because McKenzie's, I mean, basically there was really nothing wrong with his arm when they put him on the disabled list. They just wanted him to skip the start and have somebody else start because they just don't want this guy to get hurt again. He's missed quite a bit in the past. I still cannot figure out, and I'm glad he figured it out, how he went from being so wild early in the year to such a control pitcher now. And even the Indians aren't quite sure what was going on early in the season because in the minors, and the little bit he pitched with the Indians in 20, he had pretty good control. That was never a big issue with him. It was always, can he develop a breaking ball to go with the fastball? And will he not get hurt? And then, of course, he had games like he would strike out 5 in a row, walk 4 in a row. I mean, I remember there was a game like that. Another time, I think he walked 6 in a row or 5 in a row. It was just so weird. And then he went down to Columbus a couple times and seemed to figure it out. But it's exciting for me to think about those three. Morgan is my Josh Tomlin. That's how I look at him, the fifth and a half starter. And then you see some of these other guys. If you look at Double A, Plinkington, the kid that they got for Cesar Hernandez, is pitched extremely well at Akron. There's a guy they love named Cody Morris, who went all the way from Class A, and he's now at Triple A. He could end up getting a spot start, by the way. They have those doubleheaders and stuff at the end of the year. He's the guy they really like. So they've got some arms coming, you know, this wave of pitching. And this is what they felt would prevent them from falling off the map with the big payroll cuts and that, and allow them to retool and be respectable and then get back into contention fairly quickly.
You know, it's interesting, and you wrote about this in your column Sunday, and one of the other organizations that I thought of that is really good at this is the Bill Belichick Patriots. They always seem to find good guys when they're young, develop them, watch them flourish, and then they either trade them or let their contracts expire right before the downslope comes. And it's very Belichickian to me in terms of the way the Indians always seem to time this right. And you wrote about that on Sunday. It was really interesting to see how they've managed to do that. And also some of these guys in the minors that they've managed to get back in return.
I mean, if you go back through the it came from a guy named Jim Mendat, M-E-N-D-A-T, wrote me an email and said he was looking at the rotation from a few years ago, and you had Kluber. You know, Kluber's not been able to stay healthy. And you've had Clevinger. He's recovering from his second Tommy John operation. You have Bauer and all his just general problems. You know, you go right down the line, you know, a lot of the relievers, Andrew Miller, he had had arm history problems in the past there. You know, Cody Allen, you know, just kind of the things just fell off. You just see that those guys, they kind of rode them for as long as they want and let them go. And yeah, it's really dangerous to give a starting pitcher a long-term, you know, 5-year, 8-year contract just because so many of these guys get hurt.
Yeah, and
Carlos Carrasco was another one, excuse me, in the rotation. I kept thinking there's another big name. And, you know, Carlos, they did give him an extension. And then Carlos came down with leukemia. Then there were some arm problems. He tore his hamstring with the Mets. It's just been – the fact that Carlos is even pitching to me is amazing. It really is after what he went – I mean, the drugs you have to take when you're battling his form of leukemia are not anybody prescribed them. This is not the steroids for starting pitchers to go well. This is the opposite, you know. And, you know, in the 90s, it was the opposite. They couldn't find pitching.
Right. Found a lot of hitters, though. Yep.
Yeah, now they can't find hitters. Now, I'll tell you this. You look at the top of the lineup, since they – granted, they're players from elsewhere for the most part. But when you have Straw leading off and you have Jose batting second – I mean, batting second is – I'm having a complete – Ahmed. Excuse me. Here we go. So you have Straw from the Astros, Ahmed from the Mets. You have Jose from the Indians, and you have Reyes from the Padres. And actually, Zimmer's finally given him a little bit. You know, he's a farm system product. But that's a lineup that's pretty decent. And Bobby Bradley, they'll live with him striking out about 35% of the time if he is 35 homers. And he might do that. So at least there's something coming on there.
So you mentioned Jose Ramirez before. I want to get to some Cavs real quick before we end today. But can we take a minute to appreciate Jose Ramirez real fast? I was really struck by this. Paul Hoynes, he had this in his story over the weekend. So Jose stole his 20th base Saturday. He's just the third player this season to have 30 or more homers. He's got 32 and 20 or more stolen bases. The other two are Shohei Ohtani and Fernando Tatis. Those are the other two guys. And then Hoynesy also had this. Since Ramirez made his big league debut in 2013, there's only five other players who've had two seasons of 30-plus homers and 20-plus stolen bases. Mookie Betts, Francisco Lindor, Mike Trout, Trevor Story, and Christian Yelich are the others. I mean, that's some pretty amazing company that Jose Ramirez is in. And I think because he's not a real, like, outgoing personality, he doesn't seek out a lot of media, like, that is an impressive group he's in, and he's got to be one of the more underappreciated guys in baseball, right?
Put up a picture of him, if you were to do that, in your mind, and say, does this guy look like, A, he could steal 20 bases, or B, he would hit 30 homers? The answer, at least in my mind, is neither. Now, when I first saw Jose, I was actually, this goes way back, I was sitting and watching a spring training game with Shapiro because we were working on kind of some preseason stuff. And this was a game where Jose and Lindor were both deep in the Class A in the minors. And they brought them up late in the innings from minor league camp. They weren't even invited to regular camp. They were brought up late in the game, about the fifth inning, and they put Lindor at short. And I knew who he was, first round pick, and this kid's at second. And all of a sudden, Jose turns a nice double play. He whaps a single to right field. He's, by the way, he's skinny at this point. He's not bulked up, Jose. And I said to Shapiro, who's that kid? He goes, we signed him, not cost much money out of the Dominican. Actually, the real answer was they signed him for $50,000 the Dominican, which is a lot of money for Jose, but not a lot of money. And he was just a guy. And everywhere he went, he hit in the minors. You know, second base, shortstop, you know, he played third. He played the outfield for a while. This guy was willing to do anything. And that's why I'm hoping, I don't know where this goes. And it's difficult because of the labor agreement changing, David, but see about an extension with him, not 8 to 12 years, but he's got 2 years left, and, you know, try to work around that and get him some money. Maybe he could stay. It'd be nice to sign somebody. But his remark, but you're right, the 30-20 thing, you put those names out. You got to be kidding.
Yeah, it's crazy. And he's only 28 years old. It seems like he's been playing for the Indians for 15 years. Yeah, he really has.
Young. And that's why. And by the way, he didn't hit. I mean, when he first came up, he looked a little bit like Andrés Giménez. I mean, he was just a skinny kid, middle infielder, and he didn't hit that well either, especially when he started. He came up to the middle of one season, played some short, and did okay. Then the following year, they opened with him, had to send him back to the minors. He didn't hit. That's why sometimes the Indians look at, say, an Andrés Giménez or Owen Miller, where they keep saying, we got to be patient here. We got to be patient because we can miss it on this guy. You know, they ran out of patience with Urshela. He had like 400 at-bats over a couple of years. Then Toronto had him briefly. They let him go. And he goes to the Yankees and starts hitting.
Yep. Every guy's different. Every guy's different. Some get it earlier and some get it later. So, we'll talk a little Cavaliers maybe, and then we'll wrap it up. We've got, we're going to have a new feature at the end, Terry's Trivia. So we'll see if you can get the answer to the question. So it's kind of downtime for the NBA right now. A lot of people on vacation in the league, like GMs, you know, players are getting some downtime. Even some of the reporters are taking some time off. What do you think of what they've done this summer, real quick? And like, what can they do? I mean, their hands are tied in some ways here in terms of what they can do. But what do you see?
Well, going into the offseason, I thought they needed a wing player, a small forward type. And right now, they need a wing player, a small forward type, because they drafted Mobley, who was probably the best pick at that point. And they also traded for Markkanen, Lauri Markkanen. You know, they traded Larry Nance for him, who's a seven-footer. I mean, I got an email from a guy who goes, I'm interested to see the 3 7-footers play at a time, Markkanen and Jared Allen and Mobley. But in the modern NBA, that's not going to work. Where everybody's running up and down, you really need that 6'8 athletic guy. You know, it was good that they turned around and they added Rubio as a backup point guard. That'll help, but they're still really missing that piece. And I guess they could probably play a Coral there, but it's a strange looking team. Even though there's some, it's like nice parts, but what is it? If you're going to start Sexton and Garland in the backcourt, you know, a couple of guys 6'1 or 6 foot. Then I guess you go with a Coral, who's a little small for a small forward. I had a top NBA executive tell me, you know, the Cavs are good on the way to being good when they put a Coral in the backcourt with Garland. He says, that's where, and if you have Sexton off the bench, you trade him. He goes, that's a nice combination. And then they have a viable small forward. But in this case, they don't. So they've added some stuff and some parts to be a little better. I think, you know, Nance is going to be missed. Nance is really good off the floor. And on the floor, he does all the little things that, you want them to unselfish, loose balls, rebounding, defense. Analytically, it loves him for that. So interesting parts they added. I'm not sure all what's going to add up to.
Yeah, well, the season will be before we know it. And they do have some good foundational pieces. There's no doubt about that. So we'll see how things go there. All right, Terry, you ready for Terry's Trivia? Let's try it. So last week.
You were coming, but you didn't remember me what it was.
All right, so last week.
I'm down here. By the time this round will be home, we came down to Marietta, and we like to hike in Wayne Forest. And there's this big sign on the bridge for West Virginia, Ohio, you find it here.
Yeah. And it's written in crayon, right?
Yeah.
Like the crayon sign.
Yes.
Yeah. And did you find it?
I know it is coming where I'm going, what you warned me, but I have no idea what it is.
It being Terry's Trivia. Okay. You'll find it in this podcast. You ready? All right. So last week we were talking about a theme song, and you said, as long as it's not the dead skunk in the middle of the road, which I had never heard. So I wanted to find out about the song Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road. Okay. Who sang that song and what year? And then there's a second bonus part of the question.
All right. Loudon Wainwright III sang it.
Wow. Impressive.
I'm guessing it was the early 70s. And my wife, Roberta, was with me at this concert, I'm pretty sure. And it was a thing at Case Western Reserve. And he was the headliner, I may add. And they had two local folk singers. One is Alex Bevan, who's still around. And the other is a guy named John Bassett, who was really good, but died very young. And then Loudon Wainwright came out, who actually could sing normal songs, but he had these like silly bar songs. And one of them, which made the radio, Loudon Wainwright III, I do not know about the other two Loudon Wainwrights, sang that hit, Death Skunk in the Middle of the Road, Death Skunk in the Middle of the Road, Death Skunk in the Middle of the Road, Stinking of High Heaven. Now, had you written that, you would have made some money.
There you go. So now here's the second part. He has a son who was nominated for a Grammy in 2021. Yeah. Do you know who that is?
I have no clue.
His son, Rufus Wainwright, is his son.
Oh,
oddly enough. And Rufus Wainwright was nominated for his for Best Traditional Pop Vocal Album this year. He was up against the likes of Harry Connick Jr., James Taylor, who won it.
And Renee
Zellweger. So yes, check out Rufus. He's pretty well known, like in folk music circles, I think. But I haven't listened to a lot of his stuff, so I just thought I would mention that. And so now we have some new music to check out for next week's show, and you can tell me what you think of Rufus Wainwright.
All right. So,
all right, that's it. Anything else you want to talk about?
That'll do it for me, David.
All right. Well, have a great trip to Kansas City. Sounds like a great place to watch a game, and we're going to have some answers about the Browns. Not all of them, but some after Sunday. And have a great trip out there, and we'll do this again next week. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you, Terry. We'll catch you next week on Terry's Talkin'.